Okay, this is the West Coast School of the Prophets, 2009. We have a brother Roger Lewis speaking to the theme, How to Guard the Heritage of Bible Truth. This is Session 8, How to Develop and Organize Bible Study Themes. Roger.
Okay, well, we've got almost 2 hours before lunchtime to look at this next section. And I guess, actually, at this particular point of time, we come to the really critical bit. Because clearly what we established in our last session is there's a ton of resources out there, isn't there, for researching Bible study. What we do have to be prepared to do is to commit the time and the energy and our own focus if we're to extract the real value from that, whether it's audio files or research documents that we can access. There will be no shortcut in terms of the time process. Now, gathering material, therefore, in a sense, I would like to suggest, has never been easier for brothers wanting to do Bible study than it has been today, than it is today. I think that the ability that we have to access useful spiritual material is greater today than it perhaps has ever been at any stage in the history of our community, and partly because of the speed of accessibility. That all this stuff is available so quickly and so efficiently to us now, as previous generations. I mean, Robert Roberts would be astounded if you showed him, you know, Libronics, and he would just be amazed at what you could do compared to the painstaking way that they had to gather material together by reading books and thumbing through volumes. So, no problem with research. The real problem, I think, though, is the next stage, isn't it? Which is that we now have papers and papers and pages and pages. How do we now start to make sense of all this? How do we start to organise our material and to develop themes and so on and so forth? So what I'm going to talk about now is, I'm actually going to do two things. I'm going to talk about an idea that I use, which I have found very helpful. It's not mind mapping, but I guess it's sort of a similar sort of idea. And when I get to the stage of wanting to begin to think about structuring a talk, I have tended to use this particular method. So imagine I've got spread in front of me all my papers. I've got some notes that I've taken. I've got 3 or 4 printed articles with, you know, highlighted pen marking the relevant bits. You know, and I've got it all laid out, and I've now got all my material, but now I'm wanting to start and construct the actual talk. And I want to organise all of that material into some coherent sequence. Well, I think one of the keys, again, that we need to use, one of the tricks that I use for this, is you've got to go visual. And in order to go visual, you've got to get away from linear format of information. You with me on that? Because the problem with linear format, the problem with pages of notes, is it goes next page, next page, and the problem is that there might be 15 ideas on those 4 pages, but which of those 15 ideas should come first? Which should come third? Which should come seventh? And why? And the problem is you can't see them all on the same page because they're on 4 different pages. So you've got to create a visual trick that somehow allows you to now start to organise material. So I do this. And we'll talk about mind maps later. When we come to our actual talks, I'm going to suggest that you should train yourself in the methodology of using mind maps for the giving of talks. And a lot of people may use mind mapping for study as well. So I'm not saying you shouldn't use mind mapping for study, but I'll come to mind mapping because I think it's more powerful in terms of the actual talk itself. But I do this. It seems sort of pretty silly, but it works. Now, there's a name for this method. You'd never guess what the name is. I call this my circles method. And so basically what I do is I take the information and I summarise it into little sort of like pithy summaries of each main point or each main reference. and I put it into a bunch of circles. Now, what's the benefit of doing that? It's like a mind map in this sense that it's now all on one page in front of you. So now you can see the whole thing. You haven't got every single detail, but, you know, when you've read an article on something, you know, like take what we did last night about the gospel of the kingdom. What was the next one? The mystery of the gospel and the fellowship of the mystery. If you were doing that, you could go through, you could trawl through this section of Elpis Israel, and you could do two or three things. You could have a little summary of what the gospel of the kingdom was, and you might have a couple of Bible passages that were really good for that, and you've got Ephesians 3, which is about the fellowship of the mystery, and you've got a summary of what the fellowship of the mystery was, and you've got the keys of the kingdom, and Peter unlocking it in Acts 2 and Acts 10, and a cross-reference to Joel, and you've got all these circles. And so you've got it all there, but the beauty is that because it's now all in front of you visually, you can now say, okay, what starts? What's the beginning of this whole story? Where should this whole thing start? Where's the logical beginning? And even if it was this circle here, you now say, well, that's got to be number one. And I'm satisfied that that's number one. And so you've now begun the all-important process of starting to now organize the sequence of your thinking, the sequence of the information. And it's out of this that you will develop the power to deliver a good study, because you've had to spend this next stage as absolute. This stage is, in a sense, more important than your research. I'll tell you why, because... And we'll come to this, but I won't steal my own thunder, but when we come to the giving of talks, you know now that a good Bible student is probably going to study this much and present that much. And what you tend to do is tip of the iceberg. And I mean tip of the iceberg in terms of an analogy that, you know, people know that what's the amount of mass generally when you see the tip of an iceberg in the water, that actually the real size of the iceberg underneath is massively, you know, multiple size, the tip that you see protruding out. So often when you do Bible study, you've done that much, you stand up and you deliver that much, but if you've done your job properly, if anyone said, well, what about this and what about that and what about this and what about this, you can say, yep, yeah, I got the answer to all those things. It's all part of the iceberg underneath that you didn't see, but I actually did all of that. In order to present this, I had to actually study that. So therefore, what a lot of us are going to find is that all of our research can't end up in the talk. You can't just stand up. What people tend to do when they start with studies, they stand up and they say, right. And you just basically, you mow them down with stuff. Because you want to give them it all, because it's all great. And people just went... And the trouble is, you didn't have any sequence or any order, and they think that, well, I know that he was excited about it, but I haven't got a clue what he was talking about. But he was obviously passionate. And I'm really pleased that he was passionate, but I wish I understood what it was about. So the benefit of this section is now we get to the really crucial stage of sequencing the information. And so why I like this, even though it seems very simple, is because it gives you a visual link. So that you now say, okay, I think that's got to be that there, and then that's there, because those two passages are sort of connected, but they'd be the order I deal with them. And that's got to follow this, because this first quote really substantiates what I've said here in point number one. So that's, I'm satisfied that those are circles one, two, and three. Okay, now where do I go from here? Now the point is, you might change your mind. You might change your mind more than once as you go through this process. By the way, it doesn't have to be circles, but I find that that's a quick way for me to do it, is just to do some circles on a piece of paper, and then I just jot down all the key things and then say, okay, that's the basic material I've got. How do I now structure this? I mean, you could do it with separate little pieces of paper, and then you could move them all around your table if you wanted to, but that gets a bit more complicated to rip out bits of paper and shuffle them around. I find that visually I can do it just as quickly on this. And once I've done all that, then what would the next stage be? I'd probably rewrite those circles into the proper order on a fresh sheet of paper and say, okay, now let's put it in that order. And then I'd actually go right through that, because even though you can see that that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, but actually having rewritten the circles now onto a fresh sheet of paper in the correct order, now your mind can go, and now you've got the whole flow. And you will accomplish a lot by that process. And to me, the trick behind this is, not there's anything profound about it, the trick is that the whole picture is visible in the one place. So I think that's a vital key to sequencing. Have the whole picture in front of you is the easiest way of starting to sequence material. And so all you need is a mechanism that allows you to compress the information into a format that's small enough that it's all sitting on the one page, right there in front of you as you go. So what I thought we should do now by way of illustration is to actually pick a topic, any topic you like, and we'll spend some time in our groups researching the material, and then what we're going to do is we'll put the material up on a mind map first of all, and then we'll actually practice formatting that into a logical sequence in terms of our circles, and we'll actually do a practice run on this. Okay, so what we need to do for that exercise is to pick a topic. Any topic. Sorry? The gift of tongues. Okay, all right. So we're going to do the gift of tongues. So in terms of our research then, and actually the reason why, one of the other reasons why I like the circle approach is that when you're researching, you don't have to worry about the ordering of the material. You just research, just gather material. Anything that looks relevant, anything that looks possibly relevant or interesting, get it down. Because it's at that next stage that you worry about what now should be in or out and is relevant or not relevant and so on. Okay. So the gift of tongues. All right. So what we're going to do now, and the reason why I've said that is, we're going to look at the gift of tongues now, and we're not going to dispense with any particular thing. We're just going to collect everything we possibly can. All right? So your job is to collect everything you possibly can. So let's reform. So can I do the same thing as we did yesterday? Can I get you three guys to relocate to the front of this front table with your Bibles and your papers and your chairs, and these guys to turn around and these two groups to recreate? I think I might grab you two guys and just pop you into another group. Why don't you just join this group here? Is that all right? Okay. So the gift of tongues. Anything you can find. What we're going to do now is to reconvene and to put some thoughts up on the board. And remember that the objective at this stage is we're just gathering material. Only after we've gathered the material into our circles are we going to look at what we might, how we might prioritise the sequence. So let's just see how we go. So can I suggest that we do what we did the other day, which is... can you start with your most interesting piece of information, all right? So I just want a single idea or a single passage or a single piece of information from each group, and we'll just start building up our set of circles as we go. So can I start with this group here, first of all, please?
Didn't hear what you said.
Okay, all right, so give me a thought. Okay, you begin, yep.
Ephesians 4, 11 through 16, and Ephesians 2, verse 4.
So what did you say about those?
The purpose of the gift in the first place.
Oh, okay, right. The purpose of the gift. So the purpose of the gift, all right? The purpose of the gift of tongues. Right, okay. The purpose of the gift.
Or spiritual gifts in the general world.
Sorry?
The Ephesians is really a spiritual gift. Amongst these would be the gift of tongues.
What were the verses?
Yeah.
Okay, so give me the verses. Ephesians.
Ephesians 4, 11 to 16. And Hebrews 2, verse 4.
11 through 16, Hebrews 2, verse 4. Okay. What does Hebrews 2, verse 4 say?
Hebrews 2, verse 4 says, God also, bearing them witness, both with signs and wonders, and with divers miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit, according to his own will.
Okay, all right. So this is a general comment about the purpose of the gifts as a whole, not the gift of tongues specifically. But you're saying it's probably embraced within that. Okay, all right, that's good. That we'll accept that as a point. Okay. Group at the back.
Just any of them, yeah?
Yep.
1 Corinthians 14, the idea of how to use the gift of tongues and what to use it for.
All right, what was the main idea?
That it was used for edification rather than self-glorification.
Right. So 1 Corinthians 14, have you got any specific verses?
5, 6, 18, 21 through 23.
That'll do. 5, 6, 18, 21 through 23.
39.
That'll do. Okay. I'll accept that. So the gift for, I'll just put here the gift to be used for edification.
In particular, prophesying and preaching.
Okay, prophesying and preaching. Okay, yep. Okay, that's good. Group at the front.
The tongues would cease.
Okay, the gift of tongues would cease, right?
I guess the gift.
Okay. And so that is 1 Corinthians 13, verse
8.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. All right, so that's a good point. All right, back to this group again. Give me another point.
How about the future use of tongues? At the second coming of Christ, and we have Joel chapter 2, which is 28 and 32. Mm.
Right, I don't disagree with you, but let me devil's advocate you. Joel 2 was fulfilled in AD 70. Prove me. You're right, but can you prove it?
Peter doesn't quote everything in Joel 2. Peter doesn't quote everything in Joel 2.
Thank you. Thank you, I'll accept that. Just testing. Good answer, Jason. So, the gift of tongues to be seen again when? Did you say in the kingdom? Whereabouts did you say, Ben?
I said at the return of Christ.
Sorry?
At the return of Christ.
Okay, that's good. The gift of tongues to be seen again.
The great and dreadful day of the Lord.
At Christ's return, all right? We'll just leave it there, okay? So there's going to be another epoch where the gift of tongues will be in evidence. Okay. Now, again, this devil's advocating you. What does Joel 2 say about the gift of tongues?
It says pouring out the Spirit on all flesh and prophesying. You can actually use the word.
Okay, so it doesn't actually mention the gift of tongues. Right. So we probably should therefore be careful and just change that so we don't say the gift of tongues. It may be true, but we can't use that passage to prove it expressly. So just put the gifts. Shall I say the gift of prophecy? Okay, that's fine. What group are we back to? Back to this group?
Is that 2 Joel 1?
Ah, Joel 2 verses 28 to 32. Yeah, so we'll leave that. We'll leave a question mark on that one until we can clarify it. Okay. So, which group am I back to? This side, okay?
Romans 14:11, that every tongue shall confess to God.
Is that the gift of tongues?
Was it, guys?
I wouldn't have thought that was a reference to the gift of tongues. So now I'll leave that and move on. Front group. Another point from the front group.
Acts 2 is when it was first received by the apostle.
Okay, so Acts 2. Would you just like to be say what you said again? Give me the verses first of all.
Acts 2, verse 4.
Right.
They all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues.
Yep.
And then Peter, I guess everyone starts speaking, everyone can understand, so we understand when they're preaching.
All right, so the verses you want are verses 1 to, maybe verses 1 to 11. You happy with that?
Yep.
Okay, so 1 to 11. The gift of tongues. Revealed at Pentecost.
So I think the reason why we have that one up there, Nathan, is because that was the gift that was seen on the day of Pentecost. And in that context is where Joel is quoted. And they were given that ability to speak in tongues so that the truth could be preached and expand out to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Well, in the kingdom age, the job of the saints is to preach the everlasting gospel. Well, how will that be done? Because initially, the world will not all speak one language. So how is that going to be done? So the saints have to have the ability to go to all the nations and to be able to speak in their dialect and to preach the truth.
That's Mark 16, 17, 18.
So that's why I don't think there should be a question mark up there.
Okay. All right. By the way, I'm happy with that. And I always was. Because I think that's true, but you needed to verify what the connection is. And the connection is that the Joel connection is already established here in connection with the gift of tongues. You good? Okay. So, another point from this group.
We're trying to establish exactly what was the gift of tongues.
Yes.
Because it talks about in 1 Corinthians 14. 7, if any man speak in an unknown tongue, that's like by 2 or 3, 2 or at most by 3, and that's by course, that one interprets. So we're trying to determine what's this interpretation. We discovered that it actually has the idea of expounding. It's actually used that way in Luke 24:27, and we made the link to Nehemiah 8:7-8, where you had Ezra reading the law, and you had the Levites giving the sense to the people, so they were expounding that.
All right. Well, I think that's interesting. You got about 5 points there. Yeah. So let's just try and separate that out of it. So go back a step. The first thing was
establish what it was.
The purpose of the meeting and interpretation.
Where did the purpose of the meeting?
What is the gift of tongues?
Yeah. What is the gift of tongues?
Is it speaking okay. In.
So what? So. Dialogue. Right. So, what was the gift of tongues? And did you have a scriptural answer to that?
That'll be Acts 2. And
Now hear we every man in our own tongue wherein we were born.
Okay, so maybe we want to take I'll put that down. So Acts 2:7-8, all right? So Acts 2:7-8. So what was the gift of tongues? So let's just put an answer to that, right? What was it?
Speaking in different dialects.
Speaking in other dialects, okay? All right, that's fine. Now, separate to that, did you have a comment about the gift of interpretation? Is that what you were saying?
Right. Well, when we were trying to establish what it was, we saw that, well, if it's just a matter of speaking in a different dialect, if someone understood what you were saying, why would you need an interpreter? And we discovered that the interpretation was really more an expounding of what was said, not really an interpretation as we would think of as interpreting from one language to another.
Okay, now, how did you get that?
We looked at the word interpret and found that it's used in the idea of expounding as opposed to interpreting as we would translate it. Yeah, right, translate.
Okay, to expound.
Luke 24:27.
Okay, so Luke 24:27, is that the same word?
Same word.
Same word. Now, the word is used about 8 or 9 times, and it's always translated interpret. Except in this one case.
Except in Luke.
But here's the problem, though.
Yeah.
If you take it as to interpret a language, then your whole idea of what the gift of tongues was sort of goes right out the window.
How many times is it used in 1 Corinthians 14 out of the other times that it's used?
The word, what, interpret?
Yeah. Interpret or interpretation or, yeah. Do you know how many... Of the other times that the word is used, the Greek word is used, are most of them in 1 Corinthians 14?
Yes. They use a total of 6 times, and 3 times in 1 Corinthians 14. And the interesting thing in Acts 9 and 36 says... And now there was at Joppa a certain disciple named Tabitha, which by interpretation is called Dorcas.
Is that the same word?
Same word, yes.
Okay, now that's...
1 Corinthians 12:30 says, have all the gifts of healing, do all speak with tongues, do all interpret. So we thought... We had a pretty good answer for what exactly it is, but then when the verse was brought up of having interpreted there, then we thought, well, wait a minute, if everybody understands in their own dialect, why would you need an interpreter?
Okay, all right, well, let's put that down, and we'll keep coming around the group and see whether we add something to that. So back to this group here. Any other ideas?
Genesis 11, verse 6 and 9, the Tower of Babel. How God gave the men different tongues.
It supports their first circle, I think, right?
Yeah.
Right, so Genesis 11, verses 6 to 9.
Yeah.
What are you saying out of that?
That the need for the different languages.
The origin of the confusion of tongues.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good, that's fine. So it's not related to the gift of tongues per se, but it's an associated idea. It's been
interesting too that the reason that it's there is because so that they may not understand each other, so they scatter them abroad, so that they don't try and become like God, which was the purpose of it. Like they wanted to be equal with God.
Okay.
Right? And so that was the Old Testament. The reason for the tongues of the Old Testament, the reason for the tongues of the New Testament is to regather those people.
It's
to become and to learn.
Spirit of Acts 2 is that Genesis 11 is being reversed.
Yeah.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, I would agree with that. All right. So now you wanted to add another comment to that because I think you're going to... All right. And isn't there a passage about a pure tongue or a pure language?
Yeah.
All right. So let's put that down, even though it's... All right. So Zephaniah chapter 2, 3 actually, verse 9. The promise of one tongue, I'm using that word advisedly because I know it's language in the kingdom, right? But it's a relevant idea because it provides a contextual setting, doesn't it, to the concept of the gift of tongues and why they might have been needed. Because if it's sandwiched between Genesis 11 at the start of the story and Zephaniah 3 at the end of the story, now you've got an interesting contextual setting for the gift of tongues in the interim and what it might have been there for and what purposes it was going to serve. In fact, you've got a very useful framework for deciding what this gift was all about. Especially given that it's one of the major apparent evidences of the Pentecostal group, right, speaking in tongues, because I think they've completely missed the mark of what the gift of tongues was all about. And whereas we're getting onto the mark of it in terms of our biblical research here. All right, so that was that group there as well. Anything else from group number one here?
Did you do the mark point, or we got a new one? Hit your point. 22, verse 22.
You say,
all right, 1 Corinthians 14, 22, wherefore tongues are for a sign, not to them that believe, but to them that believe not. But prophesy serves not for them that believeth not, but for them which believe.
Okay.
So how can we sum that up?
Right, so that's a good quote. So 1 Corinthians 14, 22, wherefore tongues are for a sign, not to them that believe, but to them that believe not. But prophesying serveth not for them that believe not, but for them that believe. So what that's saying is that the gift of prophecy was for what? It was to expound the truth in more detail, right?
And it because the next thing he says is, if someone walks into a group and everyone's speaking in tongues and it's unbelievers, they're going to say, you're mad. But if they walk in and people are prophesying, they're going to be convicted by the truth and they're going to know that God is with you. So that almost seems like the example he uses is almost the exact opposite, where the gift of prophecy would convict the unbeliever, but the gift of tongues would leave the unbeliever thinking you were mad. And this seems like he turns that...
Only if you were speaking a different language.
It's almost like he just turns that whole example on its head right there. Right?
In the Lord's... Okay, let me just have a look. In the Lord's written with men of other tongues and other lips, I will speak unto people, and even then, before they don't think. Wherefore tongues are for sign. Yeah, look, I haven't got an answer to that straight away. I'd have to have a look at that. It seems to me that verse 22 might be the actual interruptive verse, meaning that if you read from verse 21, in the law it is written, with men of other tongues and other lips will I speak to this people, RSV says, and yet even then they will not hear me, saith the Lord. And if you went straight to verse 23, if therefore the whole ecclesia be come together, I'm wondering whether that's the contextual flow of the argument that follows, and the interpolation is 22. But anyway, the bottom line is we still would agree, wouldn't we, even if we've got a puzzle there that we haven't answered, is tongues were for those that didn't believe. In the first instance, by that, what we mean is that they'd never heard the truth before. That the tongue was a sign for purposes of advancing the truth to those who hitherto hadn't heard it. You happy with that? Okay, so that's 1 Corinthians 14, verse 22, gift of tongues.
That adds another puzzle.
What's that?
That adds another puzzle.
Yeah, to preach to, we'll say unbelievers at the moment, yep. Okay, so what's the puzzle?
In verse 1, verse 2 and in verse 14 talks about the unknown tongue, but in that it talks about the Spirit, he speaketh mysteries. If no man understandeth him, the Spirit speaketh mysteries. And also in 14 it says, if I pray in unknown tongues, which is in italics, but if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prayeth, but my understanding is unfruitful. Yeah. What's the point of praying in tongues if it's...
I think that's his point, because he's saying that you have to have the gift of interpretation, somebody with interpretation next to you.
Yes.
The thing is, if you're praying yourself, I mean, forget about interpreting for somebody else. If you're praying yourself and your mind's not edified,
I don't think that's what it's saying. I think he's talking about public prayer because it's in the context of others not understanding.
Yeah.
I think it's public prayer.
Right there in verse 13 through 19.
Yeah.
Outsiders say, "Amen." But he does say that if my spirit prays, my mind doesn't comprehend. You know, and you're just like, what?
That means somebody else must hear.
You got to say something, and someone's got to interpret for you.
Yeah.
To understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's. I mean.
See, I think we need to, again, let's just go back. I think we need to see the contextual. We don't want to get too busy into 1 Corinthians 14 because there's a whole raft of things here. But clearly what it's saying is, because there is an obvious implication here. If a person was speaking in, and by the way, you're quite right, the word unknown is in italics, so it's never an unknown tongue. It's a tongue. It's always a tongue of a known language. The question is, who knows it? But, so you should cross out the word unknown in 1 Corinthians 14. The reason is because the Pentecostals use this to have people stand up in the Yabra way in stuff that's absolute gibberish, and they claim that it's an unknown tongue, and that's not what Corinthians is saying. When people were ever speaking in tongues, they were always speaking in an actual dialect or language that potentially someone could hear. Now, I just say we don't want to get lost in 1 Corinthians 14, but I think part of the puzzle to that is that if someone had the gift of speaking in a particular dialect, but they use that gift in their own ecclesial circumstance where no one knows that dialect, then that's not helpful, is it? In the context of preaching the truth out there where that dialect was spoken, then it would advance the cause of the truth because it was the tongue was for unbelievers. But using that gift indiscriminately and inappropriate in another context of the ecclesia where no one does know that dialect became, in fact, unprofitable. And so his point was that prophecy is for the edifying of the ecclesia. In this context, speaking with tongues isn't. Because you're using it in a context where no one needs to hear it or knows. And in fact, unless there be someone there with the power of interpretation, it is actually double dutch to everyone else. Because you're not... So it's like, if Manny spoke Spanish to us now, it wouldn't be of benefit to us. But if he was speaking about the truth to a Spanish group of people, then obviously that same gift is extraordinarily useful. So I think that part of the answer in Corinthians may relate to the way in which the gifts were being used in the context.
So one more question, though, on the board is, what's the tongue of angels in 1 Corinthians 13 in verses 1 and 2?
The tongue of angels in 1 Corinthians 13 verse 2 I think just a couple of comments. I think firstly, if you were going to argue in detail, angels when they spoke only ever spoke in the tongues of men. So there is no other angelic tongue that we know of per se, because angels always communicate. I actually think that the phrase should be considered in the light of Galatians 1, verses 8 and 9. I think it is a sort of an expression of hyperbole along the lines of what Paul says in Galatians. Do you remember how in Galatians 1, verse 8, he says, "But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel," does he really mean that? Let him be accursed. Does he really mean that a real angel is really going to preach a real other gospel and really be cursed? No, he's speaking in hyperbole, isn't he? So he says, though we or even if an angel came and gave you the wrong gospel, you're not allowed to believe it. I think it's a similar expression here in 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak with the tongues of men, even with the tongues of angels, and I don't have love, there's no point to it. So it's a hyperbolic expression. And I think that parallel in Galatians chapter 1 perhaps helps us understand that. But he's not saying, I'm referring specifically to a particular tongue of angels that I'm aware of, because there may be no such thing. So I would suggest that it be regarded in that form of expression. Okay, let's come back to our board, because we need to finish this off. So what else have we got then? Any other points? Jason?
I think from 1 Corinthians 14 and Ephesians 4, you can see that both brothers and sisters have the gift of tongues. But from 1 Corinthians 14, 34, the women were not supposed to use it in the ecclesial setting.
Okay. So, gift of tongues. Possessed by both male and female. Can you just give me the quotations for that? Just that first bit. The fact that both have the gift. Can you just give me the passage for that? Because I think that's a separate...
Why don't we use Acts 2? Because it says your sons and your daughters.
Yeah, what verse?
Yeah, I'm getting there. Let
me find it. About 17, is it? 18?
Yes. 19? Yeah, Acts 2:17.
Okay, so that's quoting from Joel, isn't it? Okay. So sons and daughters. Yep. Now then, separate to that, so that's just, I think that's a separate fact in its own right, that the gift of tongues was possessed by both male and female, right? But that what you're also saying is that the gift was only to be exercised by men in ecclesial assemblies. And the proof for that is 1 Corinthians 14 verses
34.
Okay. All right, so that's a separate point, but a very useful one. Okay, so that's good, yep. So the gift of tongues possessed by both male and female, but only to be exercised by males in the assembly. Okay?
Should it be in the assemblies, or should it be assemblies slash presence of other brethren? Is it the idea of a prayer? Is it kind of like the idea of when we offer a prayer, if there isn't a brother present, then sister wouldn't give thanks or could give thanks? But if there's a brother present,
in the Greek, it's let your woman keep silence in the ecclesias. So, you could add Timothy to that and say in the presence of brethren. So that could be right. Let's just leave it at that for the moment. You may want to feel that you want to refine that. So, okay. Any other points? So let's just trawl for some final points now. I need four last points to fill the board. Surely, brethren, you can give me something more. So what else have we got?
Some who were not willing to receive, could not hear the tongues. And we get that from those who were mocking in verse 13 of Acts 2. Some of them, of different tongues, heard them speak in their own tongues. But then it says in verse 13, others mocking said, these men are full of new wine.
Okay, now... One would assume, I'll certainly put the point down, but let's just clarify it. So you're not saying that there were some that heard the tongues and mocked, but some didn't hear and mocked. Is that right? Yeah. So when it says others mocked and said, these men are full of new wine, presumably the ones that mocked didn't actually hear it spoken in a tongue that they recognised, because if they had, they certainly wouldn't have mocked, would they? So therefore, how would we describe that point again?
Oh. Ooh. No.
Some who heard not the gift mocked. Okay?
So they heard, but they couldn't understand.
Well, I would view it that they heard but didn't understand.
So that opens up a whole other dimension to that.
Because I had thought initially that there was something in their attitude and their spirit that prevented them from hearing it, from being willing to hear it. Because it says that they were mocking. So that shows us, that gives us a window into what they were really all about.
Okay, we have to say that they heard, because I think everyone heard, right? Some heard. So let's just say some heard but mocked. And then we're on safe ground. And that was, sorry, that was one verse in particular, Acts 2 verse
13.
Okay, that's good. All right, any other points? Yes?
As an example of how to conduct our services in decently and good order, in contrast of what Paul is trying to do with the issue of the tongues in 1 Corinthians 14.
What are you saying there?
I was saying how to conduct ourselves as an educational point decently and in good order, as was Paul's trying to get across in 1 Corinthians 14.
Okay, right. So can I rephrase that for you? As a point on this. So what you're saying is that the use of the gift of tongues ought not to detract from the proper order of ecclesial assemblies. Is that what you're saying?
Right, and I think that you can actually draw education from that as well.
Yeah, okay. So the use of tongues still to, I'm trying to think of the right word here. What's the reference, Ben?
1 Corinthians 14, verse 39.
Okay, let me just have a quick look at the reference.
Oh, verse 40 as well.
Okay. All right, so that's good. 39 and 40, that's fine. Okay, the use of tongues still to be used within due ecclesial order. I've used the word "use" there twice, so that's still not right, but never mind. Okay.
How does it read?
The use of tongues still to be within due ecclesial order. I really was looking for a word that's still to comply with or fall under the scope of or, be ruled by or accepted, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Okay, Josh.
14 and 18, varying degrees of the gift. I thank my God that I speak with tongues more than ye all. What does that mean, to speak more? You'd think you'd be able to either do it or not, but obviously.
Okay, so
where's your reference?
Verse 4. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 18, Paul had had the gift more than all the Corinthians.
It says he spoke more than him. Maybe it's that he did more often.
Could be more often, yeah. Or he traveled more.
What verse was it?
Verse 18.
So, what I'll put down here is varying degrees of the gift or its use. So it could be that one person had the gift of three tongues and another had the gift of only one. But it could be that all had the gift of only one tongue, but that some, like the apostle, used their gift far more frequently and extensively than others. But he still only had one tongue like everyone else. But he used it a lot more. Yes?
Oh, love that. My next one, or at least next reference, I'm trying to figure out in Mark 16 and 17.
Good passage.
Back up.
Yep.
And start with verse 15. And he said unto them, Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. And these signs shall follow them that believe. In my name shall they cast out devils that they shall speak with new tongues.
Okay, so that's a really good quote, isn't it? So Mark 16, verses 15 to 17, tells us what? It's sort of something we already know, But what it's saying is that the use of tongues
post-ascension
given to facilitate the spread of the gospel. Now, why that's a very good point is because it gives us again the contextual setting, doesn't it? If the primary use of the gifts was for the spreading of the gospel, then a Pentecostal meeting where someone stands up and speaks in an unknown tongue that no one's got a clue what it's about, that's got nothing to do with spreading the gospel. The tongue was to spread the gospel, and in order to spread the gospel, you had to transcend the barrier of language that cut people off from one another. Clearly that's what the gift of tongues was about in this context, wasn't it? And that's a very useful passage, so thanks for that one in Mark 16. I was waiting for someone to come up with that one because it's critical to the story of the gift of tongues. It's the benchmark of what it's for. Yep.
But what do you think we mean by new tongues?
Well, what do you think it means?
Tongues they don't know native.
Tongues
that aren't native.
Because it says
tongues that aren't native. Yep.
In verse 15, go into all the world.
Yep.
So the tongues they had were specific to the region that they were in.
As far as
they had to go to the new
world. To go to the new world.
See these ones to whom the Lord speaks are all Hebrews.
Correct. So not new to them.
No. So they speak Hebrew.
Correct.
But they will go forth and they will, all of them, speak with new tongues,
okay,
new to them. I mean, if they were going to speak Spanish, it wasn't new to the Spaniards.
Correct.
But it was new as far as an apostle was concerned. He would be now speaking with a new tongue. They would, all of them, experience new tongues in the preaching of the gospel. Yes,
and also, not only that, but it's 17, these signs will accompany those who believe. So
yes,
if someone speaks to you, speaks in tongues,
yes,
and that's a sign for you to know that they are a true believer.
Now, I think we will just put that on as an extra point and then we'll stop. Let me just see where to put this.
Just that word new, Thayer says it means recently made, fresh, or recent.
Is it saying
new
or
mind
world?
Yeah.
Unprecedented. So maybe it was sort of explaining that, look, more and more dialects were going to develop in time.
Or it could just be new to them.
Yeah, or new to them.
Yeah. I would still think it means new to them, and it was fresh as far as all the apostles were concerned. If an apostle was brought up in the dialect of the Hebrews and never known anything else, to suddenly have to be able to speak in Spanish, it was fresh, brand new, and unprecedented. Yes, Jim?
I wonder if we don't have on there
that
would be an obvious conclusion.
Yep.
Well, this is a Pentecostal view of
conflict. Yep, that's true. Let me just see if I can squeeze another couple of points, and I don't know how we're going to do this, but I apologise for the size. So that first one of Ben, was it yours?
The speaking tongues is a sign.
Yeah. Now that's really important. That's really important because what it's saying is, it's sort of adding to the Mark one. In fact, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll add it to this Mark one at the bottom because it's part of it, although it's a separate point. But what we're being told is the use of tongues was given to facilitate the spread of the gospel and to authenticate the message. Because how did you know that the strange man who suddenly turned up in your midst with the gospel of Jesus Christ, how do you know it was for real? The answer is because he could speak miraculously in tongues that he ought not to know about. It authenticated, it was like a miracle that authenticated the message that these men bore. It helped facilitate preaching it to other nations, but it was also a sign to authenticate the message that they gave. Both of those are implicit in Mark.
What was the reference?
Mark 16 verses 15 to 17. For both of them. Yes.
That goes along with our Hebrews 2:4 reference. It says God bore witness.
Absolutely. God bore witness. Okay. Now, was there one more point that someone wanted to raise? I think there was someone else raised their hand that they wanted to add another point.
I thought he was talking about the Pentecostal.
Oh, the Pentecostal concept is therefore wrong. Okay. Have we got a shot of that, Tom?
We'll do it now.
Okay, so let's preserve it for posterity. So now the first thing is, I know it's taken a bit longer than we thought, but was that useful research? Hands up those that have ever looked at the gift of tongues before. Okay, so not a lot. So first of all, was that useful research?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it was. Just good solid Bible research. And isn't it good doing it in a group together? Somehow group thinking stimulates your own mind. And I just think that it's a good format. That's why Schools of the Prophets is such a good idea. Iron strikes iron. And you sit there and you chat away with other brethren, and ideas start to flow and to generate, and you cross and you check and you challenge and you debate. And out of all that, good things come, and you refine your thinking and you clarify and so on. So now we've got the research down. We've done our research. So now the next stage is that you're being asked to present a talk on the gift of tongues. Now, we'll assume that we're being asked to present this talk on the gift of tongues not to an unbelieving population, but to the ecclesia. And it's a Bible class series, and your topic is the gift of tongues, a scriptural analysis. Okay? So that's your topic. So now we're about to do that. So how would we go about sequencing this now into a logical structure? Now, can you see, first of all, how beneficial it is to have everything in front of you straight away? Because immediately you can start moving visually across the board to say, so let me walk through this, because I think it's pretty logical where you'd start straight away. So would we start with the gift to be used for edification?
No.
Would we start with the gift of tongues would cease? No. That they're going to be seen again when Christ returns? No. That it was revealed at Pentecost? Could be, but no. What was the gift of tongues? No, that'll come later. What was the gift of interpretation? The origin of the confusion of tongues? Now there's a distinct possibility, because one of the things that I love to do with Bible studies is to start somewhere in the book of Genesis. And we've got a beginning in the book of Genesis, which is where most parts of the story of the Bible start. So we'll come back to that. Is it the promise of one tongue in the kingdom? No, that's obviously going to be later on. That will be one of the last points, if not the last point. The gift of tongues to preach to unbelievers? No, that'll be in the body. The gift of tongues possessed by male and female, but only used in the assembly by males? No, that'll all be in the body of the text. Some mocked later on. The use of tongues still to conform to due ecclesial order? No, that's later on. I've just found my word, haven't I? I knew there was a word. Still to conform within due ecclesial order. Varying degrees of the gift or its use? No, that's not the starting point. And the use of tongues given to facilitate the spread of the gospel? No, but it's getting pretty close. So where would we start? Are you happy we'd start with Genesis 11? Who would say Genesis 11 is probably a good place to start? So that's what we would do. And you see, why we do that is because it gives us the contextual setting of the whole story. You start in Genesis. Where does the story begin? And what we're saying is, from a biblical perspective, the story doesn't start with the coming of the gift of tongues. The story starts when tongues were first confused and divided. That's where the story starts. Why the gift of tongues was even necessary was because of what happened all the way back in Genesis. So you start your story in Genesis. So I'd like you to come with me to Genesis chapter 11. Just a thought for you, by the way, in Genesis 11. Hands up those who have either heard of or read Hyslop's Two Babylons. Okay? Now, could someone give me the main thesis of Hyslop's Two Babylons?
The apostasy rooted in Babylon.
That the apostasy is rooted in Babylonish religion and doctrine. And not only the apostasy as in the Roman Catholic Church, but what Two Babylons shows is if you go into the Indian religion, if you go into the Norwegian religion, if you go into the Egyptian religion, if you go into the Grecian religion, if you go into the Roman gods, wherever you go, it seems to all track back to Babylonish stuff. Well, I think this is the keys in Genesis. Look, verse 8, verse 7, Genesis 11. Let us go down and confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So Yahweh scattered them abroad from thence. From thence. Yahweh scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build a city. Therefore was the name of it called Babel, because Yahweh did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did Yahweh scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. And that's why Babylonish religion can be traced everywhere, because they scattered from that point. And everyone that went took the story of the Babylonish religion with them from Nimrod and Semiramis, but they took it in their own tongue. And that's a biblical foundation for why we believe that the Babylonish religion is the root of all apostate religions, because Yahweh scattered them from thence, says the record. They all had their diverse tongues and they took off. And wherever they went, they took that system with them. So that's the beginning of our whole story, isn't it? And in fact, haven't I just given you another good angle to the start of the story? Is that not only in Genesis 11 did Yahweh scatter the nations and divide their tongues, but as a result of that, they took with them wrong doctrine, wrong religion, apostate belief. And the gift of tongues in the New Testament is going to be all about Yahweh's imperative to overthrow that Babylonish origin and to actually restore people back to the true worship that they'd lost by the time Nimrod came along. So now there's going to be another part to the story. All right, so number one, excellent. So where would we go next? Well, you'd think that you'd go to Pentecost, except I wouldn't. I'd go to another passage first, because we have found a terrific passage that predates Pentecost, but gives us even the setting for Pentecost, and that's Mark 16. Because Mark 16 says that why was the tongue given, the use of tongues given? To help spread the gospel, that it was an imperative placed upon the apostles, and that it was a miraculous sign that would authenticate their message. And this is all before Pentecost happens. So now we will be able to see that Pentecost is the fulfillment of the Lord's promise in Mark 16. So I would think that number two would be probably Mark 16. And you see, it's funny how you have little connections, but you see, Genesis said, he scattered them abroad upon the face of all the earth. He did confound the language there of all the earth. He scattered them abroad upon the face of all the earth three times. And then you're going to come to Mark 16, and Mark 16 is going to say, what is Mark 16 going to say? Go ye into all the world. Is this a reversal of Genesis? And preach the gospel. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. And so there's going to be a connection of thought there in Mark 16. So I think Mark 16 is definitely where I would go as a precursor to Acts chapter 2. Can anyone follow the logic of that? Strictly logical. All right. So then let's have a look at what we've got. We've got a lot of stuff, haven't we, in Corinthians. The use of the gift, the varying degrees of the gift, male and female, only the brethren to use it in the assemblies, used to preach to unbelievers, the gift of tongues would cease. You've got a lot of that. So that's going to obviously come in the body, but probably Acts 2, therefore, is the next place to go to. Everyone comfortable with that? Yes. Why would we go to Acts 2?
Because that's when the gift of tongues starts the story in the New Testament.
That's when the gift of tongues starts the story in the New Testament. In fact, I'll just mention one other thing to you. I can't prove one of these bits, but I personally believe it's true. If you come to the Acts of the Apostles just for a moment, and I just throw this in because it might be something that we'd want to add if we were doing a talk. You know how Acts, you can divide up the Acts of the Apostles in all sorts of different ways. Some people divide it into chapters 1 to 12, the work of Peter, and chapters 13 to 28, the work of Paul. I've divided it into chapters 1 to 8, the work of Peter, and chapter 9, the work of Philip, and then chapters 10 to 28, the work of Paul, because I think that Philip's a very important personage in the spread of the truth. But do you remember what the Lord said in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8? Ye shall receive power after that the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and ye shall be witnesses unto me both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and in Samaria and unto the uttermost parts of the earth. Now, do you know that when we come to the Acts of the Apostles, there are several, I think there are four great epochs of the advance of the gospel in the Acts of the Apostles. Does anyone know what the four great epochs are?
Jerusalem,
I'll go back a step. There's four great epochs marked out by spirit manifestations. And those four epochs marked out by the giving of the Spirit as the advance of the truth is as follows. Acts chapter 2, Pentecost. And Acts chapter 2 is, sorry I haven't got another board here, but Acts chapter 2, the Spirit falls on them directly, doesn't it, from heaven, and is manifested by the gift of tongues. Right, in Acts chapter 8, Philip takes the truth to Samaria, and Philip cannot transmit the gifts because he's not an apostle. And so Peter and John come down and pray that they might receive the Spirit, for as yet he was fallen on none of them, and they laid their hands on them and they received the Holy Spirit. And although I can't prove it, I suspect that there was a speaking in tongues amongst the Samaritans as well, as one of the manifestations of the gift. The next great stage was what?
Acts 10.
The truth to Cornelius. The beginning of the truth to the uttermost parts of the earth. And we're told there in verse 44 of Acts chapter 10, while Peter yet spake these words, the Holy Spirit fell on all them that heard the word, and they of the circumcision which believed were astonished, as many as came with Peter, because that on the Gentiles also was poured out the gift of the Holy Spirit. And how did they know that? For they heard them speak with tongues. Tongues. Next great stage of the truth's advance. Pouring out of the Holy Spirit, manifestation of tongues. Last stage, Paul comes to Ephesus in Acts 19 and preaches the gospel. And when Paul had laid his hands on them, the Holy Spirit came on them and they spake with tongues and prophesied, says Acts 19 verse 6, the truth comes to Ephesus. And by now the truth has gone from Jerusalem to Shechem to Caesarea, to Ephesus. The next stage will be Rome. By the time it's gone to Rome, it's gone to the uttermost parts of the earth. The gospel's been preached to every nation under heaven. But those four stages of the Acts of the Apostles are all marked out by a manifestation of the Spirit, and I believe that they probably all were marked by the giving of tongues. The only one that doesn't say that is Acts chapter 8, but I suspect that it happened in that place because Samaritans spoke another language, a cognate language, but a different language. So it's almost as if this manifestation of the tongues, it sort of marches side by side with the preaching of the gospel. Gospel's preached to the Jews, there's tongues. Gospel's preached to the Samaritans, there's tongues. Gospel's preached to the centurion, and wherever the gospel advances, you see the Spirit gift of tongues in evidence, in evidence, in evidence, in evidence, which almost proves Mark 16, doesn't it? These signs will follow them that believe. In my name they shall speak with new tongues. So, all of that starts, however, with Acts chapter 2. So I think we'd make Acts chapter 2 our third passage. And what you might do is sneak in those other passages at that point. Now, since we're talking about structuring a talk, if I was doing that talk, what I would do is I would go to Acts 2 and I'd turn that up as a reference. And then I'd have a PowerPoint slide of the others. So instead of flicking all the other ones up, I'd say, and by the way, it looks like each great epoch of the truth's advance is accompanied by a further manifestation of the Holy Spirit and a further evidence of tongues, the gift of tongues, in fulfillment of Mark 16, that it would follow them in that preaching work. But rather than adding a whole lot of passages to turn up, I'd summarise that on an overhead slide at that particular point. That's just a separate thought about presentation really, about how you'd present that efficiently. Okay, where would we go from Acts chapter 2? Sorry, just say that again.
What the gifts are supposed to be used for.
Right.
Now that they have them.
Okay. So we've already established from Mark that they were given to facilitate the spreading of the truth. And therefore, we would probably bring together several passages now in conjunction with that. So what passages would we go to?
The top left corner one.
So these ones? And this one, what was the gift of tongues?
Yeah.
And the gift of tongues to preach to unbelievers. Mm-hmm. So maybe sort of that lot there. So if I said, well, you can only have two of those four, which ones would you choose? Bearing in mind that you can often use one passage to substantiate the same points you are going to use another passage for. So this one says the purpose of the gifts, which was to edify. Is that right? Actually, now, what was the Hebrews 2 quote?
God bearing witness by the power of the gifts of the Spirit.
Okay.
Doesn't necessarily mention the tongues there, but...
No. See, with Hebrews 2, that sort of passage, rather than turning it up as an extra passage, even though it's interesting, I would quote that there. Because Mark 16 says, these signs shall follow them that believe, and that's in the context of preaching the truth and tongues being manifested. I would probably put Hebrews in there and say, as it says in Hebrews 2 verse 4, and I'd pop it in there, and I'd just verbally mention it as a connector. And then I would actually get rid of this one, because you're going to be able to cover the purpose and use of the gifts in some other passages.
But did you just eliminate the Ephesians 6?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Gone?
Yep. I can keep it if you like.
Nowhere on the board at all anymore?
No, you can keep it on the board. I shouldn't have put a cross through it. Was that your point from your group?
No, it wasn't.
Hey, that's our point. How dare you put a cross through that? That point is sacred. My point is this. When you're constructing a talk, I have a golden rule with lectures that you should try, you don't always succeed, but you should try to use no more than 7 Bible passages that you turn up, maximum. Because if you do have an unbeliever turning up at your lecture, and you rip through 20 quotes, believe me, you're speaking in tongues, and they don't understand it. It's not a particular dialect that they know, because you've just tracked through too many Bible references. And my personal view is that even for, you know, Christadelphian talks, we need to try and, you know, limit. So we can go to every passage if we want to, but at the end of the day, people think, oh, you know, that was a bit of a truckload, wasn't it? So if we can say the same thing, but distill it down, our objective is always to get the best passage. Now, this passage was about the purpose of the gifts that they were used to edify, but that's exactly what Corinthians says.
So would we use that maybe
as a subset of that one, yeah. As a quote on the side to that one, because why would that be a superior passage to turn to than Ephesians?
It doesn't talk about tongues in Ephesians.
Because Ephesians doesn't mention tongues, but 1 Corinthians 14 does. So if we had a choice of those two, we'd probably hew to 1 Corinthians 14, because it's the whole subject is about the use of tongues and its purpose.
1 Corinthians 14, and it's just in verse chapter 4, but also, if you got to the point where you wanted to talk about the gift with cease,
yes,
which is your third, I think you definitely want to go to Ephesians chapter 4, because it says there, you know, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry, for the building of the body of Christ, until we attain the unity of the faith, of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood. And so that there's a sense in which the Spirit gives had a specific purpose, and they would. When that purpose was accomplished, and they reached mature manhood, they would cease, and I think that would be a good complement to 1 Corinthians 13.
I don't disagree with that at all, but it's actually double stating Corinthians, because 1 Corinthians says exactly the same thing, is that when that which is perfect has come, the gifts will cease. So that's saying the same thing as Ephesians 4. So now you've got two quotes to say the same thing. There's no problem in doing that, but unless the two quotes are being used to prove something in addition to one another, You're just saying the same thing with two quotes. Josh?
Would you ever, at a certain point, know where you're going to end and start from the back and sort of bring the two together in the middle?
Well, that's an interesting point you might do. And I think we already sort of know where we're going to end, don't we? Where are we going to end? We're going to end up with the promise of one tongue in the kingdom, because when that comes, the gift of tongues will no longer be necessary, and therefore even this manifestation of tongues at the return of Christ is but an interim phase until this stage is finally reached. And when this stage is finally reached, then tongues won't be necessary. So we'll probably be coming to that, I would think, at the end as the logical conclusion. And there's another reason why we'll come to that at the end as well, and I'll come back to that. So, all right. So where are we going to go from Pentecost? I would tend to get into the matter of the fact that the gift was given, it was visible at Pentecost, it appears to have been manifested in successive stages to complement the work of the preachers. And in fact, that's the substance of the 1 Corinthians 14, because once you've got to 1 Corinthians 14, you don't then want to jump in of the chapter, out of the chapter, back into the chapter, out of the chapter, back into the chapter. So you really want to say, if we're coming to Corinthians, let's come to 1 Corinthians 14 and then make several relevant points out of that chapter while we're there. So what are the relevant points that we've got? We've got the fact that the gift was to be used for preaching. We've got that it was, well, same thing here, preach to unbelievers. That it was still to conform to ecclesial order. That there were varying degrees of its use. And that it was to be exercised by men in the assemblies. So how would we try and prioritise those Corinthians passages?
Let's start at the beginning.
Can I just suggest, by the way, that maybe a helpful thing to do would be to do this? Because this is Acts 2. So while we're there talking about the manifestation of the gifts, if we were just able to clarify what was it, then we would do that while we're in Acts 2 to save necessarily coming back to make that point later on. Okay, so now we'd come to 1 Corinthians 14. So which one would you take? This or this or this or this or this is your next point.
Would you digress to interpretation first? Or would you just scrap that idea?
Sorry, what was that?
Would you digress to the interpretation point? Because you're already, if you go to Acts 2, you're going to be talking about what is the gift, speaking in diverse languages.
Okay.
Would you then just touch on interpretation or move on?
Yeah, can I just say this? There's no one right way to do a talk. And even though I'm saying how I might do it, that's simply how I might do it. That's not how you necessarily would do it, and that doesn't mean that my way's right. Let me tell you one reason why I may not do that, but I'll take this question first.
Sure. I guess at this point I would ask, would we consider more audiences now? You said that we're looking at a Bible class, not a lecture.
Exactly.
So that, for me, we're at a crossroads now.
Yeah.
Because for a Bible course, for a lecture, I would say, go to give your tongues, preach to unbelievers, 1 Corinthians 14 and 22.
Yep.
But I think it's best at this point to go to use of edification.
Yep. So having defined that our audience is an ecclesial Bible class, that affects what we might do. With regard to the matter of the gift of interpretation, and I'll come back to this later on, if you think that it's vital to this particular subject, I would put it in. If you don't think it's vital, I would take it out. Because you see, if I was asked to give a talk on the gift of tongues, I'd want to give a talk on the gift of tongues. I'd only bring in the gift of interpretation if I thought it was absolutely necessary to explain the gift of tongues. If I think that what we've said about the gift of tongues is already satisfactory, I'd regard the gift of interpretation as a digression. It's an interesting digression, but it's a digression. So let me just say one thing to you, brethren, about digressions. They're terribly interesting, but they can be the ruination of your talk. Because what digressions do is distract people off the line that you're tracking onto something else, even momentarily. No matter how fascinating it is, you've taken them offline. So the best talks always have a ruthless line that heads straight to one end, from the very start to the end. And so you only ever distract off that line if it's totally necessary for the purposes of what you're trying to prove. That's my personal view. It's only my personal view. I think the best talks are where there is a line that's so clear that people feel that they're driven irresistibly. They're enjoying it, by the way. They're not resisting it. But they feel that they're being driven irresistibly down that line, and they love the logic of the Bible that drives them down that line. Don't distract if you can possibly avoid it. I think it's one of the golden rules of good talks and structuring talks. So when it comes to the gift of interpretation, I would probably think, to my mind, I would think at this stage, it perhaps is an unnecessary distraction that I would not put into the talk, unless I felt that it served a vital purpose. So I'm going to leave that out and say I wouldn't do that. So I'll just put a little cross mark here, since my friend in the front row is not too keen on me crossing the whole circle out. So if we were going to do something in Corinthians, which probably is what we should do, what would we say? I'll just complicate matters for you here. I think we'll make this number 5. Why would we make that number 5?
Wouldn't you want to just jump to the bond in Corinth? So I'm going to jump straight into Corinthians chapter 14. I can't do that. I have to give some context to say what's going on in Corinth.
Sure.
What's some of the history? Why is this an issue so much here?
Yep.
And what is Paul trying to accomplish in this chapter? If I just start diving into Paul's points, Paul's sort of assuming that you already know why he's bringing this up and what the problem is and what the problem he's trying to address. So you sort of have to start there, and then you can get into what Paul has to say.
Yeah, I've got no problem with that at all. I completely agree with that. You'd want to have some contextual setting to the 1 Corinthians 14 before you spoke about it and before you make any points out of it. So absolutely right. So we'd want another little circle here that says something about that. So we want here context of 1 Corinthians 14. But only in as much as it's relevant to what we're about to say in the chapter. It probably actually, in this particular case, Ben, you're absolutely right, because to understand what on earth he might be saying in that chapter, you've got to know a bit about what's he writing about and why is he even writing about it and why did he even need to raise this. And the answer is because there were some problems in this particular ecclesia in the context of the use of the gifts, including the use of tongues. So he's writing to correct those problems. So we'd certainly want some contextual setting for that. So you notice I've added number 5 here, gifts possessed by both male and female. Why did I add it there? Because it's Acts 2. So we might as well cover that in Acts 2. So you've digested Acts 2. You've digested the fact that it was revealed there, it was what it was, and the fact that it was possessed by both male and female. And of course, the reason why you'll say that is because it was in fulfillment of Joel 2 anyway, which said that was going to happen. Okay.
But Roger, don't you, the actual references that you do turn up?
Yes.
And you may side quote something?
Yes.
Or we may eliminate things. But the ones that we actually have people turn to?
Yes.
We would want to give at least some sort of a context.
That's right.
Of where we're going.
Exactly.
Right? Now, like Ben's saying, when I take it to Acts chapter 2, I need to really sort of spend a little bit of time.
Yes.
Laying it out. But in every
Acts
you turn up, don't we want to sort of.
Okay, Acts 2, let me just say something in that regard, because these are all valuable things to debate. Even a contextual setting could be a distraction. Don't imagine that you have to give a contextual setting to every passage that you turn up. These are Christadelphians. They know a thing or two about the Bible. They know that Acts 2 is about Pentecost. Christadelphians know that Acts 2 is about the Pentecostal outpouring. They already know that. So don't spend too much time giving a setting to Acts 2 to Christadelphians who already know about it, because what is that? A distraction. You've taken them off the line again. Unless it's essential to the point that you're going to make to Acts 2. I think you could go in most cases with Christadelphians straight to Acts 2 and say, we just want to notice two or three critical things about Acts 2, because this is really where the gift of tongues starts in the New Testament record, in fulfillment of Mark 16 that we've just looked at. But it's here in Acts 2 that story starts. here at the Pentecostal outpouring, not only will the gift of the Holy Spirit be manifested, but in one of its forms, one of its principal forms, it will be seen as the gift of tongues. And now away we go into several key things. Now, I wouldn't need to say anything more about Acts 2, I don't think. Anything more becomes a distraction to the line that you're trying to drive along. So let's just try and summarise, because I notice we've only got 5 minutes left and this took just a tad longer than I thought. So for ease, I would say that we would go to 1 Corinthians chapter 14 at that stage. And in terms of the sequence, I wonder whether what we would do is to say that we would maybe do 6 and 7. Would we want to use the fact that only men use it in the assemblies? Yes or no?
No.
I would say probably I wouldn't mention that, because whilst it's true, it's not essential to the thrust of our story of the manifestation of tongues. In fact, it becomes a distraction, because we've just said that male and female both had it, and now you're trying to say, well, they did, but they didn't both use it in the same way, because actually what happened is in the meetings, the men used it and the woman didn't, which begs the question, well, when did the woman use it? Well, they used it in different times. Could they use it when her brother was there? Why did I raise this? Why did I raise... See what happens? You get distracted. So you try not to do that. Yes, Jason?
If you are the one... How it was used. So if you're not going to bring that one in, you should probably take out the whole part of the man.
No, I would definitely leave it in, because the point that it's making is that male and female were using a gift and they were converting male and female. And one of the reasons perhaps why females used the gift was to convert other females. That woman would relate to a woman that was able to, you know, to preach. And there was evidence that occurred, but not in the assemblies. I think my point is that I think you could say that by means of a comment rather than turning up yet another reference. So rather than saying, now, if you come to Corinthians chapter 14, we notice this, and now we've got to read the verses and explain, I would just say something. I'd say that the rule was, in the assemblies of the ecclesia, the men only exercised their spirit gift. In fact, if I was to say something, if I was to enjoy a brief but momentary distraction at that point, what I would say is, and isn't it surprising that in the very chapter that says that the women are not to speak in the assemblies is in the context of a chapter regulating the use of the gift of tongues, and yet at most Pentecostal assemblies, most of the speakers in tongues are women.
Yep.
All right? And I'd say that I would accept that as a momentary distraction simply because it's a good point, but you can say it quickly enough without losing your line.
We roll for yes, right, Josh. Should the use of the tongue still conform with the ecclesial order?
Yep, okay.
All that gets rolled together.
So all of that gets rolled together, exactly. All right, so rolled together with what?
The use of tongues still to conform with an ecclesial bottom. Yeah, that one.
Okay, all right, so we'll do that there, okay? The varying degrees of the gift and its use, I might say I'm not sure whether I put that in, because, again, the point would be, well, what's the point I'm trying to make and why am I raising it? The answer is I'm not sure at this stage, so... I don't think it's essential to the thrust of the message, so I'd leave that. So what are we left with?
Are you going to go to the gift back, the gift ceases, and then you're going to go to the gift coming back?
Exactly. So we're going to go up to here, that the time is going to come when the gift would cease, and the gift would cease for two reasons. The gift would cease for two reasons. Firstly, as 1 Corinthians 13 says, because the ecclesia had reached a state of maturity in love that enabled it now to function as the body of Christ without such miraculous additions. And secondly, because we're told in Colossians chapter 1 that the gospel had been preached to every creature under heaven. So if the gift of tongues was given in Mark 16 to facilitate the preaching of the gospel, and Colossians 1 says that the gospel has now been preached to every creature under heaven, then it's not needed anymore. It's fulfilled its task. And I think that one of the key things that we would say out of that is to make the point that the gift of tongues, in common with other gifts, were given for a limited period for a specific objective. They were never given indiscriminately for all time. They were given at certain epochs to achieve certain things in the divine purpose, which when once achieved, the gift was no longer necessary. And so we notice that that's the promise of 1 Corinthians 13. And that therefore we conclude that Mark 16 must have been achieved at that stage, whenever the gift ceased. And it will come again because there's another imperative that the world is yet to be transformed beyond even the preaching of the apostles. And the final state of things prophesied in Joel betokens a last final manifestation of the outpouring of the gift one more time, so that the era and the epoch of the kingdom can be introduced to all the world. And in that day we believe that the gift of tongues will be seen for one last time. But even then, it's only for this purpose that finally, when the kingdom is thoroughly established and all the world bowed to Christ's command, I'll turn to them one pure language, that they may serve God with one consent. And why that's the perfect place to close is because Zephaniah 3 verse 9 is the ultimate reversal of Genesis 11. From a multiplicity of tongues to one single tongue. And whereas Genesis 11 the tongues were given to divide everyone, in Zephaniah the tongue will be given to unite everyone once and for all around the common truth of serving Yahweh with one consent. And when that tongue comes, a gift of other tongues won't be needed anymore, because everyone will hear and everyone will know and everyone will understand and everyone will worship perfectly together, and the purpose of God will be fulfilled. That's not a bad talk. But in order to do that, we've got to spend some time sequencing it. And yet, the moment we do that, we end up with all of that material, which was just research, just stuff thrown into the pot. But out of it, a sequence emerges, which has got logic and structure to it. And I believe that if you did that talk, you went home and did that talk, people would stand there and say, that was great. That was clear. Boy, I understood that. That was good. Because it's got just a simple line that walks you through from, it's got a lovely beginning, a logical beginning. It's got the perfect end. It's got the body in the middle that walks you through the actual story of the gift of tongues and why and how it was used. So, thank you for that choice of topics. It wasn't the easiest one to select, you know. When he said, let's do gift of tongues, what did you all think? Oh, no, gift of tongues. But in fact, you've constructed an excellent talk. But see how the circles are useful? Because visually, you've got the whole thing in front of you. Now you can sequence the material. So I commend that to your attention and remind you all that it's lunchtime.